This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can join the conversation on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. You can call us at 860-275-7266. It's 2019, and we're back. We're here once again with Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Happy New Year, Colin.
Happy New Year, Mr. Dankosky.
Also with us is Dan Harr. He's editor and columnist at Hearst Connecticut Media. He's just running off the streets, and here he is. Danny, good to see you. Happy New Year.
I was walking fast. Happy 2019.
Happy 2019 to you. And Susan Bigelow is here. She's a contributor to ctnewsjunkie.com. Happy New Year to you, Susan.
Well, Happy New Year.
And it's good to have everyone here. Ned Lamont is going to have a big day 1 week from today. It's inauguration day. He's going to take the oath of office, and he's announced some of his cabinet picks. We'll be talking about that. We've been talking about the people he's been putting in his administration over the course of the last few weeks. It's fair to say that Ned Lamont is going to lead the state a little bit differently than Dan Malloy. In one way, at least, he plans to be a little bit more collaborative and maybe less confrontational. Senate Republican leader Len Fasano is quoted by our friend Daniela Altomare in the Hartford Courant as saying that Fasano already has a better working relationship with Lamont than he ever did with Malloy. That's good, I suppose. Will Lamont be able to lay down the law with both Republicans and Democrats when he needs to, however? Colin, let's start with you. You read the Ned Lamont profile by Daniela Altomare, collaboration over confrontation. Do you expect a much different sort of leader in the governor's office?
I think we even said this during the campaign, and it's one of the things that's been evident. I mean, in a way, it's not news to say this. We've known all along. First of all, you would have to go to some lengths to become a more confrontational, less dismissive of other people's opinions person than Dan Malloy. Whatever his strengths are, and we'll talk about those later, that was just always the case. So, and we know enough about Ned Lamont to know he's not anything like that guy. So it stands to reason, yes, that he was always going to be more collaborative, try to get as many people in the room, try to reach consensus, try not to have – I think one thing – that you're hearing from Fasano that's very typical of the legislature and part of their major area of dissatisfaction with Malloy is that they don't like the idea that you've already made up your mind before you start talking to them. You have to at least pretend to be persuadable. And that was a problem. Malloy often felt he knew the right answer and that other answers were wrong answers before anybody sat down with him. And so, yeah, if you start there, I mean, you're going to at least for a while. I'll just say one other quick thing.
Yeah.
This is – I mean, nobody really knows what kind of governor Lamont is going to be. I mean, until the shooting starts, you really just don't know. He's sending a lot of pretty good signs. I think a lot of his picks are really good. We'll talk about those. But we really don't know too much. We'll know – and we won't know much in January or February. You know, maybe by the end of the first legislative session, we'll have some idea.
Susan, when you hear him compared, even from some within his administration, to Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker, a Republican, somebody who is seen as a conservative, but a conservative that you can work with, certainly no friend or fan of the Trump version of the Republican Party. Ned Lamont is seen by some as a liberal Democrat, but by many others as a much more conservative type of Democrat than what we've seen in the past. Does the Charlie Baker, I don't know, does the Charlie Baker mold hold up to you?
I think it does at least a little bit. Of course, we haven't seen him in action yet, but the idea of sort of an affable, easy to get along with person who's sort of mildly fiscally conservative, and you know, there's some evidence that that's how Ned Lamont's going to be, is that he's going to be more fiscally conservative than maybe some Democrats might like him to be. But that is something that actually works pretty well for a New England state. It's something that works very well in Massachusetts. Charlie Baker is still a very, very popular governor. He won his reelection race by like 30 points or something like that. So that is a model that could possibly work very well here. But again, we'll see how it goes. It's hard to say. It's hard to predict right now.
Danny?
Charlie Baker did draw more votes than Elizabeth Warren, which is not going unnoticed. Can you revise history that hasn't happened yet? Because it seems like by calling Lamont some kind of conservative, that's what we're doing. He ran as a liberal. He was the guy who went back way back in March to the AFL-CIO and wowed them with his commitment to labor and his commitment to not letting anything be taken away from them. And so I hear that he's going to be – he says words like, no, I do not want to see tolls, and no, there will not be an increase in the income tax. But he's run as a liberal, and I think the difference between him and the legislature is not so much going to be ideology. They're in the same place, is that he's the adult. He's – as the governor, he's the guy in the room who has to say no to something. And they can't do all 10 of the things that they're talking about doing and still run a state.
Well, and last time we did this with our friend Keith Faniff, our budget guru from the Connecticut Mirror here, Keith repeatedly said, Danny, actually, you won't be able to do any of the things that are on your list because first you have to dig out of this gigantic hole. And Lamont, as the adult in the room, probably is going to have to tell some of his Democratic friends that's the main thing we're going to focus on for the first year.
That's the key. And the slide that we should be looking at is not so much ideology, but technocracy versus ideology. And he's more of a technocrat, I think, than an ideologue.
Colin?
Yeah, I actually don't think it's entirely true that fiscal considerations will be the only considerations. I mean, Keith is kind of the party of no once you start talking about that. I think it is possible for there to be initiatives, first of all, that are revenue neutral or maybe even revenue positive that aren't necessarily budget reform. I think, once again, you got to my guess is that what it'll do the first year is not too much. Partly because of the budget problems, but also partly because it takes a while. It takes a little while to sort of figure out. And he's not going to be a bull in a china shop, too. He's going to sort of figure out a little bit more about how the legislature works. Hopefully, anyway, he's going to do that. He's showing every sign of doing that. But, you know, maybe we can segue a little bit more into some of these kind of so-called cabinet appointments, too. The cabinet appointments suggest something of an extension of Malloyism, such as it is. You've got a major prison reform, a prison reform guy with a national reputation. But, I mean, Malloy was all about reducing the prison population. He's already done a lot of pretty major reforms of that Lamont will inherit. I think his DOT pick looks like an extension probably of Jim Redeker, you know, not terribly different. I'm a guy with a tremendous rail background. I'm talking about the new guy, Ravella as the public safety chief. Also, probably not a big departure, probably not going to do too many things that don't fit with sort of the what we would kind of call Malloyism.
Yeah. Well, go ahead, Danny.
I will say I agree with that on grounds of what people believe in and what we expect them to do. Mm-hmm. I think that the transportation pick is a little bit more high-speed rail and
trainees,
all that stuff.
Super training.
Yes, right.
Super trains. Are we going to get the super trains?
There have been some insider Democrats who thought they were going to get commissionerships who have not. Mm. Whose names I don't want to say, but they have not gotten jobs that they thought they were going to get in favor of outsiders who Lamont perceives to be perhaps more professional.
Yeah, it's an interesting mix of people, Susan, who are inside and outside. The rail guy we're talking about, Joseph Giulietti, and on the DOC side, kind of this interesting recruiting. It was like a star basketball player that they wanted to come to UConn. They found this guy, Rollin Cook from Utah, that I guess was up for other jobs across the country.
Yeah, and there's apparently some sort of a national recruiting effort by a lot of other places to try and get this guy. And it's very interesting that he's landed here. As for our new transportation chief, he's a rail guy. He came from Metro North itself. And he's going to be replacing Jim Redeker, who is another rail guy. He was a big New Jersey transit sort of guy. So there's probably not going to be a lot of shift in focus there. What is interesting, though, is obviously Ned Lamont understands how important Metro North is to the state. It's probably the most important transportation system that we have. And as for his record with Metro North, that depends on who you ask. Certainly he made the railroad safer. Whether or not he made it run more on time really does depend on, all right, Metro North statistics say that they're doing pretty well. Commuters, on the other hand, although they like to complain, commuters say that it's not quite as great. So, again, we'll see. But we do expect that he's going to be focused more on Metro North.
Metro North, Danny, maybe not the model that we're trying to replicate with this new Hartford line. It is the most important commuter rail line in all of the country, and it has its problems.
Well, it's the biggest. And the big debate at Metro North right now is whether to spend limited money on the track bed itself to increase speeds and performance, or on the sort of accessories around it, you know, the shoes and handbags. The $100 million on a parking garage, a new parking garage in Stamford, or $100 million straightening the tracks in certain places. I vote the latter, but the so far the leaning is towards the accessories.
Did you have a you want to jump in?
I did. We have to remember that Metro North, that track is laid down on a path that's about 100 years old. Mm-hmm. And it's very, very winding, and it's very – a lot of the infrastructure there is very old. So straightening the track actually would be a very important thing. I wish they would do that.
I always tell people – I mean, so Connecticut, for the most part, has a whole bunch of voters who just gripe all the time about any money that's spent on mass transit. They don't like spending money that way. And then there's a subset, there's a different group of people who have been alluded to already who are regular users of mass transit who spend all their time complaining about it. So the number of people who are happy about any aspect of transit is a very, very small number. But the people who complain about money spent on mass transit, I always say, did you watch Mad Men? Well, until we built CT Fast Track, we hadn't built any new mass transit lines since the time of Mad Men. The stuff that Pete Campbell was taking to get home to his, you know, wife in Westport or something, that's just basically what we have now. Except that it's worse because it's degraded and deteriorated for all the reasons that Susan is saying. I mean, we actually weren't as good, really. I mean, at least our train lines aren't as in as good shape as they probably were when the characters on Mad Men were using them. So,
Let's actually transition to the newer rail line, the one that runs between Springfield and New Haven. Danny Haar has been writing about it. This Hartford line comes with a fairly hefty price tag. One of the questions is it worth the investment? Dan Malloy, as part of the tour at the end of his administration, trying to crow about some of the things that he's done. He took the Hartford line to Springfield last Thursday with Representative John Larson and Massachusetts Congressman Richard Neal. Here's a little bit of Malloy answering questions about big subsidies from government for rail travel.
They'll say, well, we're subsidizing rail travel. Well, what do you think building highways is? What do you think plowing snow is? That's a subsidy.
So, Dan, you've been looking closely at this. It's sort of early to say, but how do you think the money spent on the Hartford line is doing so far?
The only way it pays for itself is if Bill Gates rides the train, the next Bill Gates, you know, the 22-year-old Bill Gates, rides the train, likes the vista of the Windsor Locks Canal, which you go right over the canal. It's really a fantastic Connecticut Valley History Tour, what that train is, likes it so much and decides that he's going to take that vacant warehouse space on the right that used to be all of Dexter Corporation, some of it vacant, and build the next Microsoft here. Because as a way of moving people, it's right now it's about $60 per person, I believe, plus debt. And so that compares to $4 per trip on Metro North, 40, which is the highest we have in the state now, 40 per trip on Shoreline East, which has big problems with ridership and other problems. So it's a big number.
What Dan Malloy says in that soundbite, though, is, but look, it costs a certain number of dollars to rebuild a highway to make sure that 91 and 84 and 95 are running anyway, and we're putting cars on them and they're polluting the environment and it's causing gigantic traffic slowdowns. I mean, we're subsidizing that travel too, aren't we?
Yeah, massively. And we do subsidize. One of the biggest subsidies that motorists get is free parking. How many free parking spaces do you use? And those things cost money. And so if you walk to the mall, do you get a 40% discount? You should. And so he's right, but he's wrong, because most of those costs are paid for by car-related taxes.
If you walk to almost any mall in Connecticut, you won't get hit as you're trying to cross 17 lanes of traffic. But Susan?
I don't think we can actually evaluate mass transit just by dollars spent per ride and whether or not it pays for itself. Mass transit's never going to pay for itself. That's not the point. Mass transit's not there to make money. It's there to move people, and it's there to make quality of life better. That factory that you were talking about in Windsor Locks, that's actually being converted to apartments as a transit-oriented development, because a train station, the old Windsor Locks train station is right there, is going to be refurbished and reopened at some point, and that's going to be a Hartford Line stop if we can get the money for it. Part of the problem, though, is just startup costs are so high. putting in another line of track is just very expensive. It's very expensive to build any transportation project here. The busway was very expensive. The Hartford line is very expensive for a lot of different reasons. It's more expensive to build transportation infrastructure here than it is, in, for example, in Europe or China. So that's part of the problem. But I think it's a lot of the intangibles that we get out of a mass transit line like this. Really, you have to take that into consideration.
It's sort of like the yard goats, right? I mean, the yard goats are a failure if you just look at what they do on the books of the city of Hartford. They're going to sit there losing money. I mean, the Hartford does not collect as much money from the having the yard goats there as they pay to have the yard goats there, or to pay for that stadium anyway. And mass transit is a little bit like that, except that it's more crucial probably than a double-A baseball team. You have to build capacity. You don't have any choice. Why do businesses and people migrate towards the Boston area? It's not because the taxes are lower, but the fact that you can get around on mass transit in Boston is a very, very significant difference between here and there. You just have to build the capacity. And then as soon Susan suggests, intermodally, a lot of things are going to gradually happen. It's going to take a while. This is called planning for the future, something Connecticut's been really, really bad at for a long time. But you also got these cohorts of millennials and people younger than millennials who don't like cars as much as their predecessors, who expect to be able to live in urban or quasi-urban areas where they don't have to get around by car all the time. If you want to be that place, you've got to build capacity. And as Susan said, it's going to be expensive.
I will just quickly say that Boston indeed does have better, more robust public transportation than any place in Connecticut. However, the Boston subway system is even older than Mad Men, and it has a gigantic problem right now in terms of ridership on the Green Line as it's trying to be rebuilt.
Yeah, the Green Line's a mess. I did want to mention, though, that Representative Richard Neal, who was on the train with Dan Malloy, he's the incoming head of the House Ways and Means Committee. So there's always a possibility that more federal money will be coming for this line.
Oh, and maybe for John Larson's tunnel.
My daughter yes. lives 30 feet from the Green Line, and it is, in fact, a bit of a mess. But it's certainly something that regions need to have. I agree with that. And Frank Zappa said you need a football team, an airline, and a beer to be a country. He didn't talk about regions, but you do need a commuter rail. The point is, how do you run it and at what point? Maybe Colin is right about the yard goats. We should sell CT Rail hats. I think I've spent $300 on yard goat hats, giving them as gifts to people who have left. And maybe they'll come back.
Can I just quickly ask a question, if anybody has a take, on another of the new cabinet hires? The DEP commissioner, D-E-E-P, it used to just be DEP, the Department of Environmental Protection. Then they added on an extra E for energy, and it's become even more so an energy department. Katie Dykes is someone who I know pretty well. I've talked with a number of times. She comes from PURA. She is someone who is very involved in the energy sector. Some people, Dan, might take a look at this appointment and say, are we getting further from the mission of environmental protection and further into the mission of energy promotion?
Well, the real issue here is that energy is so complicated that Katie Dykes is the only person in the state who actually understands the energy markets. So she's the one who got the job. They should add another E for efficiency, because DEEP has done more than any other agency to do more with fewer people in getting those environmental permits through. So they're becoming sort of a commodity, and that's not a bad thing.
Well, there's another efficiency E, which is the ability for people to get energy efficiency programs into their home, something that the legislature previously has stripped money out of and makes it very, very hard. Do you have a thought on this, Susan? I mean, we're getting away from the old mission of the DEP when we are so focused on energy, including the possibility of building more infrastructure for gas pipelines. I'm wondering if this is the way we're going.
Well, it probably is for now. You can't sort of extricate, though, energy from the environment at this point. There's, especially if we're talking about developing more renewable energy. And that's something I'm hoping that this department, despite what the legislature's done, that's what I'm hoping this department will actually do, is more renewable energy sources.
Dan's shaking his head.
You're killing me. You're killing me. First of all, they caved to the nuclear industry with Millstone, with calling that now renewable energy, which is sort of hilarious. And second of all, the cost that we're paying for that is something that we have to start looking at. It's enough is enough is enough already with Connecticut trying to solve the world's problems when the rest of the world is doing nothing about it.
Colin, quick thought?
Wanted to say PURA, where she comes from, is our utility regulation authority. It's had many, many different names as opposed to being a hand sanitizer or a cat food or whatever it is. It sounds like. So I just the one thing that I would say is this has always been kind of a Frankenstein agency, right? It's a couple of things stuck together that do belong together, but on the other hand, don't have completely congruent aims. So the old DEP was involved in conservation and compliance with environmental regulation. The energy mission is a little bit different. I mean, obviously, if you don't get your energy house in order, you're going to have a crappy environment. But though they're not exactly the same thing. And I think, first of all, the jury's out and it should be out. She should be given a chance to see how she does at absorbing those first two aims, which are a little less part of her resume, right? Environmental conservation, environmental regulation compliance. We'll see how she does meshing that with what she does know about energy.
We do know a very sharp person indeed, so we'll see how that goes. When we come back from our break, we're going to talk a little bit more about Dan Malloy on the way out, including taking a look at the portrait that has already been commissioned and completed of him. It's an unusual portrait. Our friends Colin McEnroe, Susan Bigelow, and Dan Haar will have some ideas about that on The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can join our conversation at WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. The cameras of CT and the Connecticut Network are also here today. You can give us a call at 860-275-7266. We're joined today by Susan Bigelow, a contributor to CTNewsJunkie.com, Dan Haar, editor and columnist at Hearst Connecticut Media, and our own Colin McEnroe, who hosts the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hey, Colin, what's on your show today?
We're coming back with some coverage of ideas that kind of cropped up over the weekend, ranging from the Trump administration's impact slash war on American wildlife. We'll also talk a little bit about the hack of the Tribune newspaper company that took place over the weekend and what that might have been. And it was sort of a story that almost got a little bit lost. I just also want to say that on Thursday, we will air a one-hour or full-hour interview with Dan Malloy, whom we're about to talk about. And then on Friday, we're very happy to have John Dankosky back as a panelist on The Nose. I have one other thing I want to say very quickly. For the 35 of the last 36 years, I've been a columnist for the Hartford Current, and I've been with the Hartford Current in some form or other since I started as an intern in 75. I believe that I've written my last column for them. I'll say a little bit more where I'm going and what I'm going to do later. But I have nothing but fond memories and great associations with the Hartford Current. I'm doing this voluntarily. Nobody should be mad at the Hartford Current, assuming that anybody possibly would be. So breaking news.
So that is some breaking news, and maybe we'll hear a little bit more about that breaking news coming up on your show later on today?
We'll cover the news today.
We'll cover the news today. Colin McEnroe with some big news. And again, Dan Malloy on the program tomorrow. Give us one little hint, one little preview of something you talked with Dan Malloy about.
So Danny and I were talking about this. We were at a New Year's Day party yesterday. We were talking a little bit about this. The one thing that I would say, and this can maybe set up our conversation a bit, he's an extraordinarily difficult person to interview, kind of for the reason that I was saying at the beginning, where he already knows the answer. He already knows what he thinks about everything. One of the things you do as an interviewer, and John, you're a much more skilled interviewer than I am, but you use words to try to close the distance between yourself and the other person. Dan Malloy uses words usually to maintain distance between himself and another person, sometimes even to create more distance between himself. So he's very, very hard to interview. I did try as hard as anybody could, I think, to get him to talk a little bit more about the impact of Sandy Hook on him as a person. And I don't think I got very far. It's not an interview that I wish I could promote it as this really fantastic, revelatory interview. I can't. I don't think I got him off his game very much.
But it will be interesting to hear, Danny.
I've spent the last 18 hours anguishing over whether I, too, use words to create distance or to bridge differences. I'm not sure. That's a tough one.
I've spent the last 20 years trying to figure out how you're using words, and I don't know.
So. Words. I have good words, the best words. I will say this about Governor Malloy. You can talk with him about policy. And if you want to talk with him about policy, he can sit and talk with you for 5 or 10 minutes about any really small detail of something. And I don't know. I haven't had enough conversations with Ned Lamont. I guess this is the last time we'll get to call him Ned. Hey, Ned. I'm not sure that he's eager to or willing to talk about policy on that level. And that's a good thing. I don't think we should overlook that in respect to Governor Malloy. You know, no, he's been the porcupine, and he picks the people that he wants to get the end result on panels and all that sort of thing. Doesn't get along with the legislature. But you can talk about the thing itself with him. It's not all just about management.
I just want to play, actually. We have a little clip of Dan Malloy talking with Colin McEnroe to promote to tomorrow's interview. Let's listen.
I never thought I'd have a second term, so I worked as hard as I could and raised as many issues as I could in the first 4 years. And lo and behold, I ended up getting reelected. And so I went back to the game book and said, let's take on as many issues as we can this 4 years. And that's what we did.
Susan, can I ask you about that? As we hear that
I was snorting a little bit.
Politicians actually, when they say something like, I never thought I'd have a second term, they can't possibly mean that. I mean, he governed for the first 4 years and then ran in order to make sure he had a second term, I think, in large part. Whenever you hear that, well, I was surprised, and so we just did as much as we can, does that strike you as being completely truthful?
With him? Man, maybe a little bit. I think that there's a kernel of truth there. I think many people were surprised that he won a second term. One thing that struck me about him is that he cares less than the average politician does about popularity, about how people perceive him, I think. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, he does have an image and he does cultivate it, especially in the national stage, which is a whole different thing. But he's someone, I think, who was actually willing to take risks that he may not have taken otherwise. He was willing to raise the taxes, willing to butt heads with the legislature, willing to alienate teachers and things like this that maybe would not have happened if he had been more concerned about reelection and more concerned about his own popularity. And there was something sort of freeing about that I liked.
Colin?
First of all, I think Susan's dead on. I go a little bit further and say, Malloy, pretty good governor, terrible politician. Terrible politician. It's amazing he gets elected to anything. He really doesn't take care of the business that you have to take care of as a politician. And so he's very bad at telling his own story and very bad at recruiting allies to help him tell his story. One of Malloy's biggest problems for 8 years was that there was almost nobody else willing to step forward. Nobody from CBIA or Democratic leadership in the legislature. Say, oh, no, actually, he's doing a pretty good job with this problem or that problem. So what do you have? You have a guy. There's some things that he has done, which I hope we can get to, that I won't be able to forgive him for. But let's give the guy credit. He did a lot of things that a reformist Republican governor would probably try to do. He cut the size of the state workforce substantially. He reconfigured pensions so that people coming into the system are coming in a less expensive way than the people who will depart from the pension system. He replenished the complete empty rainy day fund. He repaid some of the borrowing that was done by, well, all of the borrowing that was done by Jody Rowell and the legislature to balance the previous budget. He actually started, he's the first governor ever to make payments, the actual required scheduled payments into the pension system. So for all those reasons, he's been kind of a fiscally appropriate and kind of almost Republican-ish governor. But nobody knows that story. The story of Dan Malloy in this state is of a guy who presided over a dumpster fire. And I think that's inaccurate, but it's a product of what a bad politician he is and how bad he is at telling his own story.
The dumpster fire, I think, is important. We have to remember that I think Dan Malloy came into office at one of the worst possible times. The state economy was in such bad shape. We were in the middle of the recession. I think he had the worst sort of field. He had the worst setup that any governor has had since Lowell Weicker. And I think he dealt with it pretty well, I think better than we really give him credit for.
He came into office at a great time during the time when the nation was recovering. For Connecticut, it turned out to be a bad time, not because of the recession and its after effects, but because of the nature of demographics, where people wanted to live. The big problem in Connecticut is we don't have any big magnet cities. That's the problem. It has nothing to do with spending.
Actually, since we're talking about Malloy's legacy, let's do a little bit of art criticism. And it's interesting that in some ways, Colin, an official portrait could just be a picture of someone who is leaving office, sitting with their hands folded, looking directly at the artist. And that's all it is. Dan Malloy's portrait is different in a lot of ways and actually wraps in an awful lot of the story that he wants to tell about who he is and what he did in the job.
Right. So there are all these Easter eggs in there. I think Susan might have been the person who pointed this out. So I'll let her say a little bit more about it. But there's like all this stuff that you have to kind of decode that's in there, references to various things. I'll have her handle this. So, yes, this is a very kinetic portrait. I think the best comparison that I've heard, it was on my Facebook page today, somebody said it looked like he looks like a left-handed pitcher in a big windup. So the glove hand is kind of flung forward, you know, the way maybe Randy Johnson or somebody might. And then,
people on CTN, it's just sort of.
Yeah, there you go. So, I mean, iconographically, there's a little bit of the Sistine Chapel. There's a little bit of Gilbert Stuart's famous so-called Lansdowne portrait of George Washington, where he also has that arm extended, but palm up, not palm down. And then there's also, I think, a little bit of distortion. I keep looking at that arm. And I keep thinking about Mr. Fantastic from the Fantastic Four. It seems like his arm is a little too long. So I don't know. I guess the one thing that I did want to say, we were saying this off the air, if you know Dan Malloy at all, and maybe nobody knows Dan Malloy at all, but I mean if you see Dan Malloy a lot, there are some emotions and attitudes that he carries in his face. And I don't think they're there in this portrait.
Hmm. Susan, I'll let you talk about some of the Easter eggs before we get Dan's art criticism.
That actually was not me that talked about the
Easter eggs. Oh, it was not you? Okay.
So I have no idea what's in there. I do think it's a lovely painting. I have no idea who the person in it is. but it's very, very interesting, and there certainly is a lot going on.
Yeah, it's submarines on the wall. There's a gay pride flag on the desk. There's portraits in the back that are obviously.
I think there's a Sandy Hook bracelet, maybe.
There's a few different things.
And there's also a reference to the Syrian immigrants and the Profiles in Courage Award he got.
All three major pieces of military hardware that are built: the submarine, the King Stallion helicopter, and the Pratt & Whitney jet engines are in there.
He didn't get Dan Hart's mysterious jar of liquid into the portrait.
but he
has in every appearance on the wheelhouse.
No, but the Profile in Courage Award looks like it could hold liquid if you pour it in. I took the trouble to go to the State Museum and Library Museum website and looked at all the portraits, and I have concluded that the 12 labeled icons on the official profile, the official brochure of the official portrait, which I'm holding in my hand.
Oh yes.
Total a larger number of identifiable icons than are in all the other portraits combined.
My goodness.
Governor Ribicoff is sitting with the county map of Connecticut, which seems ironic because isn't he the one who got rid of counties?
I'm not sure.
That was later.
It was later.
Yeah.
Okay, good. So
we
he
should
has
say
the
name.
Map.
I think could we say the name of the artist, which I believe is it Christopher Zhang? I don't know how to say his last name. I don't want to say it wrong either. It's Christopher Zhang. Is that how we would say that? I'm not sure.
Okay.
Governor
Malloy told me in my interview with him he was very proud, and he said this before to other people. He's very proud of the fact that the artist is an immigrant. And so what he's doing is he's taking a literal approach to this. Rather than to try and capture who he is, he really cared about labeling and literalness. And I think you can
– what he did, yes. not who he is.
Right. That's right. And I think you can extend that to his tenure as well. He doesn't care who he is. He wants to be known for what he did. And so this is why the portrait comes out the way it does.
I was struck by this column because and inside this brochure, I'm glad Dan brought this, it actually has references to the naval submarine, to
that's
the flags.
No fun.
And it gives away all the little Easter eggs. My grandfather in the 1970s had commissioned a cartoon. I don't know if you remember these, but caricature artists were very good at asking you a few things that you really cared about and then drawing a picture of you with an oversized head. And let's say you liked golf and whistling a tune and you were an engineer and you liked baseball. They would give you a portrait with a baseball glove and golf clubs and you'd be whistling a tune. And that's how this reads to me. And the hyper-literalness of it I think it makes it very weak as a piece of art. But
well,
maybe that's exactly the story that Dan Malloy wants to tell.
Danny just said something that I really kind of agree with, which is he doesn't really want to be understood. He doesn't want people to know who he is. And I think when I think about the qualities he carries around in his face. There is this sense, not that it's a mask exactly, but there's sort of an odd kind of tightness where he's not going to relax and tell you that much about himself. I just do want to say, as maybe just as we round out this a little bit, you know, I said at the beginning, there's some things. I actually think he's going to be understood by history as a pretty good governor, a reform governor who fixed a lot of things that Ned Lamont is expected to fix, but it turns out a lot of them have already been fixed, or at least the beginnings of the solution are now in place in a way that will be very helpful to Lamont. I do think it has to be observed that Malloy always seemed hostile towards clean election reform, the very clean election reform that got him elected in the first place, put through a bill to weaken some of its provisions, then tried to skitter around those, or was part of an effort to skitter around those provisions and got in a fair amount of trouble for it. Also tried to immediately upon ascending to office to weaken the watchdog agencies, consolidate them in a way that allowed for more centralized control. I think that's going to be a problem for his legacy. And the other, if Keith were here, I think that he'd say the other problem for his legacy is he spent so much money on the corporate welfare end of economic development that he didn't have money to do a lot of the programs he wanted to do. Once you've spent that much money essentially paying businesses to stay here or to come here, you're out of money.
If I didn't know better, I would have thought you had just said that his weakening of election regulations and laws would have been an effect on his legacy. That seems odd. The public doesn't seem to care about that stuff.
Maybe
at all.
They don't.
I want to get to two quick phone calls before we turn back to the incoming governor very quickly. Dave's in Woodbury. Hi, Dave.
Hi.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Well, you know, I wanted to revisit the idea of funding for the DEEP. And just to quickly add something, I want to actually give some accolades to the folks over there at the DEEP. I'm a licensed arborist, and Connecticut has the oldest arborist law in the country. We used to have a very, very strong enforcement because the program has such high integrity. But when the DEEP lost a lot of its funding, they were left doing a heck of a lot more with very little money. So I have a lot of empathy for the folks that are over there working with our industry as arborists. And I can only tell you that our industry has been pretty much devastated as far as the enforcement goes because of the lack of money. And I really hope Lamont comes in and helps out that agency to bring them to the staffing that they had prior to the Malloy administration.
Well, hey, Dave, thank you very much for that. I just want to get to one other quick phone call from our previous conversation. Janice in Stonington. Hi, Janice.
Hi.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Yeah. One of the things that next week is the Consumer Electronics Show, and I'm covering that. I've been going since 2006. It's 170,000 of your closest friends and 4,000 vendors. One of the most important trends out of the five or six major trends that they're covering is smart cities. And I was amazed that sometimes we just don't have the long-term view in Connecticut. Maybe we have to start out with smart towns versus smart cities. But the infrastructure and the things that we need to support it need to start now.
Janice, thank you very much for that. I want to take that phone call in part, Dan, because you've been looking at some of the bold ideas coming from the Lamont transition groups. And I'm wondering, as we think about, you know, how we're going to enforce environmental protections, how we're going to grow into smart towns or cities, do you see big, bold ideas coming from the Lamont incoming administration?
Some. To the caller's point about smart cities, I want to turn that around and look at it from the other side. The education group, the working group, these were the 15 working groups, and I graded the boldest, what I thought was the boldest idea of each and how it does. The highest grade I gave was to the group that says, we need to get rid of these tiny little small school districts. And that relates to smart city planning precisely because the problem with Connecticut and urban planning is not technology. It is fiefdoms, all these little fiefdoms. And Commissioner Redeker at DOT has had a lot of problems getting towns to work with transit-oriented development, not because they don't want the development, because of the zoning.
Yeah. Susan, you were nodding your head vigorously.
Yeah, especially the school districts thing. That's something I've been writing about for a really long time. it does hamper our growth because it does also force our towns to compete with one another and do some things that are probably not good for our long-term future. Zoning is actually tied right into that stuff too. So consolidating school districts is a really good idea, but until we can get beyond our 169 little fiefdoms, it's going to be real hard.
Other bold ideas that Dan gave at least passing grades to, or better than passing grades to, a Northeast Summit. A group advised Lamont to convene a summit on economic growth with governors of states that touch Connecticut, maybe a little bit more collaboration, less competition. And of course, we knew this was coming, Colin. Full-scale tolls, not just the truck tolls that he was talking about.
Right. Toll everybody. Pedestrians. I mean, you know, we've had so many conversations about tolls on this show. I will say whatever they do is going to be kind of a drop in the bucket, or at least it's like a half a cup of water in a big bucket in terms of ameliorating our fiscal stress. I mean, it's better to have some money than to not have that money at all. My guess is that with a bunch of new faces in the legislature and a kind of a shakedown going, they might not, and some resistance, they may not get there in this session. But tolls are coming.
Quick thought, Dan?
It's worth $10 million to study it. I'm referring to one of the
don't
things
get me started. Yeah,
most criticized about Malloy was the $10 million toll study. But I do think that there's going to be something that comes out of it this session. It may only be a study.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to air some of our grievances, maybe talk about some feats of strength that we've seen as we head into 2019. We're talking with Dan Haar, editor and columnist at Hearst Connecticut Media, Susan Bigelow, contributor to CTNewsJunkie.com, and Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show here on Connecticut Public Radio. This is The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky talking about the week's news with Dan Haar from Hearst Connecticut Media, with Colin McEnroe from The Colin McEnroe Show, and Susan Bigelow, a contributor to CTNewsJunkie.com. In just a moment, we're going to hear from our panelists about some of the things that they're grumbling about or maybe some things they want to praise this week. But I will say that something happened over the course of the last couple of days, Susan. It looks like we already have the first big 2020 presidential contender. Yes, Elizabeth Warren stood outside her home with her husband and said, yes, I am going to run for president, or at least form an exploratory committee. And people said, well, that's not exactly the same as running for president. And then the next day she got on a plane and went to Iowa. So I guess that means she's actually running for president. Yes, of course, it's early. But what do we think about Elizabeth Warren kind of being the first high-profile person to really get in?
Well, not a big surprise. Obviously, people were kind of expecting that she was going to do this. The reaction from progressives, which is kind of that's where her base is going to be, has been a lot more muted than maybe it would have been if she jumped in 2016. I feel like Elizabeth Warren may have missed her shot. There's going to be so many people getting in to this race. You've got the Bernie people. You've got Beto O'Rourke. There's other progressives that are out there that I think are going to steal a lot of the thunder from her. That said, she's going to be a really interesting candidate. She's got she's another detail-oriented person. She's got a lot of expertise and a lot of knowledge about the issues. I'm interested to see where she takes the conversation, but I don't like her chances right now.
Mm. Dan Haar?
Democrats need to figure out a way to get somebody on the ballot in 2020 who's not identified with a very strong liberal ideology or with a very strong liberal era, that is someone who's over 70, which it seems like all the front runners are going to be, or someone who is racially or ethnically identified. They need to knock it off, or we're going to have another Republican president, and this time for 8 years, not the four that Trump is going to serve.
You're whittling down the pool very
yes,
quickly,
very
though.
Much. Yes, yes, yes. I don't understand why the Democrats can't go with somebody like Mitch Landrieu, who's a centrist heartland Democrat. Why does it have to be an old liberal from one of the coasts? I don't get it.
So you're going to see a bunch of other people jump in pretty soon, because once one person jumps, then everybody's handlers go, well, we better get in pretty soon too. So you'll see some others. I think I'm in communion with my fellow panelists here. I will say that a lot of this, it's sort of a job that you don't quite understand yet, because I think it's all predicated on the assumption that Trump will be the nominee in 2020. If he's not, then we're really looking at a completely different job, basically. But let's assume for a moment that it is Trump in 2020. I feel as though, you know, they talk in polling about the generic Democrat or the generic Republican. Well, the generic Democrat will probably be able to beat Trump. And the less generic you are, the bigger the problem is. So if you have distinguishing characteristics, you know, which I think Warren has. Danny just enumerated some of them. There was also this incredible bungle with this absolutely cockeyed DNA test stunt, you know, which is going to follow her around. And I actually think that the kind of person who's going to be a little bit more successful, you know, I mean, I guess everybody has secrets that can come out, but the Klobuchars and the Sherrod Browns and the people like that, maybe Mitch Landrieu, those kinds of people who don't, there's no reason not to vote for them, except that if you don't vote for Democrats. But if you've got some other little backstory that's hanging out there waiting to be chopped off, I say you shouldn't run against Trump, because somebody with no baggage can beat Trump.
We got to move on to our last segment here, Susan, and we've been doing this for the last couple of weeks, and I really enjoy this, asking people for either feats of strength or airing of some grievances. You can do both if you'd like. What would you choose today?
I have a grievance.
You have a grievance. Oh, no.
I had tickets for Hamilton, and I got sick, and I couldn't go. And I'm just – I am very bummed out about this. So, hey, if anybody's got an extra ticket out there you know where to find me. Yeah, no, it's too late. But yes,
I'm so sorry about that.
No, as I got terribly sick and could not go, and it was very sad.
So your grievance is against illness, human illness.
My grievance is against myself, really.
I'm so sorry.
My weak frame has let me down.
I'm so sorry that you missed that. Danny, how about you?
Well, I don't have a grievance against myself or anybody else. I'm starting the year with a new resolution with fewer grievances. So
good for you.
This is going to be the new positive Dan Hoare. I'm going to pick up on Hamilton. I think that it's cliched and it's hyped and all that stuff. But having gone, I think it overlives the hype. It's unbelievable. It changes both the content and the form. It brings something that we never would have thought was going to sort of excite the population into you know, the modern era. And, you know, we just said today, not going to miss your shot. Somebody, you talked about it.
With Warren.
And it's just become part of the iconography of American intellectual landscape.
I know that you're trying to be kinder in this new year, but poor Susan over here is like, what did I miss? You've just basically
said anything of a lifetime.
That's also a song from Hamilton.
Well,
what did I miss?
Not going to miss my shot.
No, you're not going to throw away your shot.
So you really love Hamilton. You saw Hamilton twice while I was here.
Yeah. No, I'm a big believer already, and I've been through the cast album, you know, 70 times, and it still manages to surprise me. And it was fun having it in Hartford. I was at Story and Soil the other day. There were a couple of the swing cast members in there getting coffee. And, you know, when you have something like that going on, I think it's really, really good for the city. So speaking of, I've got some feats of strength, too.
Good.
Things that are good for cities, I think. So I'm going to go away from what I thought I was going to say.
Okay.
And I'm going to, first of all, shout out the Village of Starnington. I was there over the holiday weekend. And it's, you know, it really is this incredibly dense, preserved place. There's this beautiful old building after interesting old building after quirky old building all through that village. And, of course, you can go down to Bombster's and get terrific scallops to take home as a little memory. I think it's amazing. And then right next door in Westerly, I always feel like independent bookstores are coming back a little bit. So they've got a place. They took an old hotel near the train station, rehabbed it, turned it into the Savoy Bookstore and Cafe. And it's beautiful, a beautiful old wood paneling, independent bookstore. But, yeah, obviously, as the cafe suggests, they're doing coffee and pastries and stuff like that, because you have to do that. You can't just sell books anymore. And I just thought, wow, that's just such a great sign of health when you see, I think they're only about 3 years old. The Social Coffee Shop in Stonington, which is, I think, almost brand new, is terrific. And then this bookstore in Westerly.
And if you take the Shoreline East to the bookstore, you can get a double subsidy.
Oh, I didn't even think of that.
Do you have favorite bookstores or coffee houses, Susan?
A favorite one? Oh, man.
I'm touring around now. I'm thinking of
like a couple of places I really like up in South Hadley in Massachusetts. And I can't remember the names right now, but there's a bunch of them up in Western Mass that are really fantastic.
Dan, how about you? Is this something that you frequent? Is this something part of your tour?
I still like R.J. Julia. I think it's a great place.
I'm going to end with a feat of strength here, and we got word that one of the real movers and shakers of Hartford stepped down from her position at the end of this past year. Dolly McLean, who helped to found the Artist Collective with her husband Jackie McLean, has retired, stepping down. The Artist Collective, of course, has been something that hundreds and thousands of young people from the city of Hartford and the surrounding region, they've learned about their culture. They've learned about music. They've learned about dance. And I've met some tremendously talented people who've gone on to be professional musicians and really credit everything to Dolly McLean and to Jackie McLean with her. So I wanted to celebrate her and her long career. I will also say, Danny, I know this is something we've been following a little bit. The Arts Collective has undergone a little bit of a hard financial time. We've seen recently that maybe they may have a deal to get out from under some of their debt and some of their problems working with Capital Community College. But it's a really important part of our civic life.
Yeah, we're in an era when hard infrastructure rather than soft infrastructure is getting more support. And the arts groups are at relatively low cost. You can do a whole lot with the arts groups. And that's a great example.
Yeah, so congratulations to Dolly and everyone at the Artist Collective. I want to thank Danny Haar from Hearst Connecticut Media. I want to thank Susan, of course, Bigelow, who came here from ctnewsjunkie.com. As always, Susan, great to see you.
Thank you.
And thank you so much to Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show. Thank you, Colin.
Thank you, Mr. Dan Cosby.
Our program is produced by Scott Brady. Our executive producer is Katie Talarski. Kion Wolf is the technical producer. Betsy Kaplan also helped out with the show today. Thanks so much, and happy 2019.